This program is a production of WAMC News. From Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly half-hour review of New York State government and politics. Your host is political scientist and syndicated columnist Dr. Alan Shartok of the State University.
In this edition of the Legislative Gazette, we'll hear from someone who has seen the operation of the legislature from the inside. There's an old saying, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. But Republicans in the Assembly aren't rallying around that slogan these days. In fact, they say there's a lot that needs fixing within the legislature. After the vote in favor of a major pay raise late last year, the minority Republicans set up a task force to investigate ways of streamlining operations. Rich Lepkowski updates that story.
How to improve the New York State legislature? Let me count the ways. That's the job of a study group created last December by Assembly Minority Leader Clarence Rappelier after lawmakers voted themselves 30% pay raises in a lame duck session. Rappelier's study group was designed to examine ways to improve legislative accountability and effectiveness in the 150-member state assembly. That includes studying how other state legislatures work and reviewing material already written on legislative management. One of the main areas to be examined by Assembly Republicans, the rules under which the Assembly operates. But Assemblyman Alan Hevesy, a Democrat from Queens, who, while serving as a professor at the City University of New York, wrote a book on legislative management, says there is no need to change the rules in the Assembly. In 1975, when Democrats took control of New York's lower house, they implemented a number of rules that opened up the workings of the Assembly. In the Senate, however, says Hevesy, much of the work is done behind closed doors, and the majority leader in the Senate and committee chairman have the powers to kill any legislation on a whim. But Hevesy says that is not the case in the Assembly.
The rules work pretty well. They provide for as open a legislative body and as democratic a legislative body as there is in the country. That doesn't mean there aren't legislators who don't have power. We don't open our system by eliminating power. We do centralize power in the hands of the Speaker and the majority party leadership, but that's a healthy thing. What we've also done is opened up the system and made it accessible to the public and to the reporters and lobbyists and so on.
But the Republicans maintain there is room for improvement. Assemblyman John Sheffer of Erie County is chairing the GOP study group. He identifies a number of areas of concern, everything from computer application to member management, from committee management to whether or not New York's legislature should become a true full-time legislature. But as far as rules are concerned, Sheffer says there's one aspect built into the legislative process that causes him great concern.
Just to give an example, almost everyone in the state knows that the overwhelming majority of bills in the state legislature are passed in the last several weeks of the session. And before that, a relative handful of bills. And the question is, does that make any sense? Can we possibly be on top of that huge number of bills, hundreds and hundreds of bills, in that last couple of weeks in order to be voting intelligently and competently? And getting to the heart of that type of management issue is what our study group is all about.
Democrat Hevesy, meanwhile, says the rush to end a legislative session is an interesting dilemma, a dilemma he says every legislature in this country faces. But Hevesy is not sure the problem can or should be averted. He compares the situation to labor negotiations, where deadlines play an important part in the negotiating process.
If a bill is non-controversial, there's no opposition, or there's an easy agreement, it can be passed at any time. And a percentage of bills are passed, so that even in January, we'll pass 15, 20, 25 bills in a given day, a given session. Why hundreds of bills at the end of session? We have hundreds of bills, not only in New York, but in every state of the Union, every legislature, the Congress as well, for the following reason. Where there is a disagreement on a bill, where there are competing interests, where there's opposition as well as support, and where the final product that comes out has to be negotiated and compromised, those compromises those negotiations cannot be completed until there's an artificial, fixed, final deadline, where the deadline is worse for all the parties than not coming to an agreement. In other words, if the session is going to be over and you're not going to pass anything, that has to be portrayed as being worse than not making the concessions that have to be made in the bargaining and the compromising.
Compensation is another key topic, according to Assembly Republicans. Republican leader Rappelier created the study group after lawmakers voted themselves pay raises, making them the highest-paid state lawmakers in the continental United States a month after state elections. In addition, some legislative aides earn more than $70,000 a year, much more than lawmakers, and many of the aides have much more political clout than individual lawmakers. Should legislators be allowed to vote themselves or staff members pay raises in a lame duck session? Sheffer says compensation, both of legislators and staff, is being examined very closely by the Republican study group.
Certainly the compensation issue of both staff and members is one of the things we're looking at, which of course is necessary in doing a competent job of looking at the whole dollar and cost effectiveness issue. And it's clearly true that the price tag on running the New York legislature is higher than most every other state. And the question is, are services being delivered that are corollary with that high price tag? And if not, why not, and what can be done about it?
The pay increase is well deserved. We get paid relatively low salaries. It depends on who you're comparing us with. If we should earn as much as a full-time teamster driving a rig on the highways, I think the people who run the state government and who make life and death decisions ought to be paid commensurate with their ability and with the time that they put in. We do some very heavy, serious stuff. It's very complicated and technical. Some legislators are extremely diligent, others less so, but if you're not diligent at all, you're defeated in the next election. So I think the salary increases were well-deserved. I voted for them. I think Rappelier voted for them. And I think a majority of the Republicans voted for them, as did the Democrats.
The debate over compensation for lawmakers could center around one very important question. Is the New York State Legislature a full-time or a part-time legislature? The state constitution is very vague on this point, and some lawmakers say they opposed the pay raises back in December because they believed $43,000 plus was a heck of a lot of money to pay a part-time worker. But Democrat Hevesy claims there is not one single member of the New York State Legislature that does not work a 40-hour week at his or her job.
If you compute only the days we're formally in session, you might argue it's part-time because we're in session only the first 6 months of the year, although for the last 6 or 7 years we've been going back in the fall. But if you add up the hours that legislators expend on the job, which includes home district work, working with the community school boards, dealing with potholes, going to fairs, both ceremonial and business, handling thousands, literally, of constituent questions and problems, it is clearly a full-time job.
Assembly Speaker Stanley Fink was reported not very pleased to hear that the Republican minority had taken up the task of examining ways of streamlining the legislative process in the Assembly. And a spokesman for Fink says if the Republicans think they've got it bad in the Assembly, they should look at the rules the minority Democrats are up against in the state Senate. In any event, the Republican study group should have some recommendations on ways to improve the legislative process in the Assembly before the end of the year. In Albany, I'm Rick Lepkowski.
One of the most respected women on the staff of the New York State Legislature is Ross Graham, who leaves her boss, Minority Leader Manfred Orenstein, after 21 years of service. I asked her if things had changed in the legislature.
What kinds of major changes have you seen in this legislature in 21 years?
Oh, enormous changes. This starting with the quality of both the legislature and of the staff. When I first came, the legislature was genuinely part-time, and not part-time in what I think of as a good sense. And the legislature was just a stepping stone for most legislators. They wanted to move on to other things. Now I think that many of them really recognize that state government is a useful end in and of itself, and while they may not want to stay an assembly person or a state senator, they become really involved in how the state operates. And I think and they're all much harder working, and or at least the general group is harder working, I think, intellectually, of a higher caliber. And the staff has, doubled, tripled, quadrupled, quintupled in size, and clearly is much more competent than it was in general when I first came.
You came, you have always been a feminist. You came, you were appalled at what you first saw up here, I know that. You represented probably the most liberal district in New York State, if not in the United States, Chelsea, Greenwich Village, that area. You know them all. Have things gotten better for women in the legislature and because of the legislature in the time that you've been here?
In the legislature, yes. That is, for people who work in the legislature, some of that has to do simply because we've elected more women to the legislature. When the first women came into the state senate in the early 70s, they really, Karen Burstein, Carol Bellamy, Marianne Krupczyk, they raised the consciousness of the other legislators enormously. And that has been something with which we've moved forward. The growth of professional women staff people has helped. Just the sheer numbers makes a difference. And so women are no longer solely sex objects or the coffee carriers they used to be. I think, in fact, one of the things that's happened is that people have begun to recognize the value of a genuinely good secretary in a way that they didn't.
How's that?
20 years ago. Well, because it used to be that a secretary answered the phone, opened the mail, got your coffee, sewed on your buttons for you, but was not expected to be able to think for herself. Now I think that as legislators have begun to need more and more staff, because we are like Parkinson's, and once you start, you want more.
Too much, Ross? An awful long silence.
In bits and places. I mean, I don't know too much overall. I would make some changes within the pattern if I were God and running the place. But one of the things is that people have now begun to use secretaries and their brains for the things that they're very good at, and good secretaries are terrific organizers. Many legislators, many other staff people, I need organizing all the time, so I'm very conscious of how useful that quality is of itself.
You have had a lot to do with something called the Center for Women in Government. You've been on their founding board. You've been working with them for many years to redress inequalities. What about inequalities in the legislature? One of the things that women have been very strong for, feminists have been very strong for in the last couple of years, is something called comparable worth, which we've spoken of on this program a number of times. And that would pay women equally for the kind of work that they do for men. So now, you've just been talking about secretaries, and I think implying, I think correctly from what I've seen, that some of the secretaries around this place, around the legislature, work a good deal harder than even many of the legislators and many of the other staff, and that they are the, quote, gatekeepers. They're the ones who say who can come in, who can't go out, sort of organize a person's professional life up here. So Are they properly compensated for what they do?
Some secretaries are and some aren't. Both the curse and the wonder of the legislature is that it is a law unto itself, and therefore, in fact, can set compensation as it chooses. On our staff, we have valued that because it has allowed us to reward those who need to be rewarded specially within the limits of our pie, and we like the flexibility of being able to make the decisions ourselves rather than having to live with very rigid G2, G3 lines. On the other hand, the disadvantage of that is that those people who do not value given work will pay as little as they can get away with. Now, it's much better than it used to be. And I think the new new Supreme Court decision on determining whether is saying that we must give overtime as opposed to comp time is going to be a very interesting battle. I don't know how they're going to resolve that. And in fact, while I recognize why the Supreme Court did it, I do think there are differences here that need somehow to be taken into account. And I think that probably on certain salary levels, people would prefer the comp time to the overtime.
Is this a sexist legislature?
Yeah.
Okay, that's a good answer. Now let me see if we can expand on it a little bit.
As with everything else, it's a lot better than it used to be. But just because, I mean, it is essentially because it's a reflection of society itself, and I think society still is sexist. I think in many respects we remain, unfortunately, a racist society, too. It's the same kinds of things. It's the prejudices many were brought up with and continue to perpetuate. Even today, I'm every once in a while recognizing a prejudice that I didn't think I had in me, and I think that that's true everywhere. So that it's in the legislature, there still is surprise when a woman really understands money. There still is an assumption that women's issues are so-called soft issues or health, say, never remembering that, in fact, the root problem with health delivery at this point is money or the lack of it and understanding how to spend it. So there's still kind of surprise when a woman has those abilities, particularly a woman who does not have a doctorate in something or other or is not a lawyer. I think, and I can see it even among our most feminist staff members, the automatic assumption that somehow because you're a lawyer, you're better. I think that means you have different skills or you've learned how to deal with them differently. And I recognize the skills of lawyers. But I don't think that a lawyer is the only person who can look at a piece of legislation and have good ideas about it.
What are your greatest frustrations with the place?
Oh, golly. Probably as an institution, that's harder for me to say because so much of it is mixed up with the fact that all of my time here, except for one session, was spent in the minority. And it's always tough when you think you could do it better to be in a position where you can't do it better. Because the institution means in the minority you don't have that kind of power to set the agenda. And so I suppose that's part of it, is that I would like to be able to set the agenda.
Well, now, as executive assistant to the minority leader, have you seen any changes in the way in which the minority is treated in the legislature?
Oh, yeah, sure. A lot of changes. Now, that really has to do with, A, the legislature growing up, and, B, the minority, at least in the Senate, becoming a much more cohesive force of its own and much more together and therefore more important. I should say that one of the major changes that occurred in the legislature occurred in the last 10 years when the legislature itself developed the ability to argue with the governor about revenue projection. So that now the argument is not just how we spend the money, but whether we actually have this kind of money or where it's coming from and how much is coming from what source.
But the minority seems to...
Therefore, the legislature will never be the kind of rubber stamp it was frequently under Governor Rockefeller. Now, that's not to say that Governor Rockefeller was better or worse than anybody else. It was just that we weren't capable of doing those things. One of the things that has happened as the minority, say, in the Senate, has become more cohesive is that we have learned to take advantage of the legislative knowledge, staff, people, machinery, whatever, so that we, too, can participate on a relatively equal level.
But how do you make the Republicans do that?
Well, one of the ways that it happens in the Senate is that, fortunately... they only have a 5-vote margin or a 4-vote margin over the 31 they need to pass a bill. I listened to Jack Hagerty the other day at
the Republican staff chief.
That's right, at a Taft seminar in New York, in which he talked very strongly about the Republican belief that no bill should come to the floor that they don't have the votes for. They only want to pass bills on the floor. They genuinely don't want to just discuss them. They only want to bring bills that are going to pass. They want to pass all bills with only their own votes. They don't want to need our votes for anything. Well, that can't always happen, particularly on very tough, big, controversial bills. There are also some in which I think Senator Anderson really does want some of us, just so that he doesn't take all the blame. But if they're going to have to let 4 or 5 or 6 or 8 senators go their own way, because they don't have monolithic control either, then they need some of our votes. And particularly when it comes to budget time, city needs, they need our votes. And one of the things that has happened over the last several years is that the Democratic Conference has become so much a group effort that... when it's important, we can deliver anywhere from 21 to all 26 of our votes. And that's a good, hefty number. That means we can demand something in return. And what we demand in return is that we participate. We don't want to vote for something that we didn't have a hand in shaping.
You're leaving after 21 years. First of all, the question always comes to mind to anybody who's listening is why? And B, is there life after the legislature?
Well, the second question I'll find out. the first question was that, you know, this 21 years is the longest I've held a job for a long time. Before I started to work for the legislature, I think I had not worked at anything for more than 4 or 5 years. So this was a long haul for me. I really thought the time had come for a change. And what I wanted to do was set my own agenda. And I don't know what I'm going to do afterwards. I'm assuming that while I delighted last week in spending 3 hours in the middle of a weekday at the Modern Museum of Art, I'm not going to want to do that all the time. So I assume that I will want to find other things to do, but I don't know what yet, and so we'll see. I'll let you know.
Ross Graham.
Ross Graham is retiring from legislative life and her work as executive assistant to Senate Minority Leader Manfred Orenstein. What an incredible woman. What a force in the legislature. What a decent person. While Ross and I have frequently disagreed on issues, I still regard her as a mentor. When I showed up in the legislature to intern for Ornstein's Mental Health Committee in 1965, the year the Democrats won the Senate by mistake, the first person I met was Ross Graham. She was brand new herself, but she made friends everywhere she went. Everyone knew Ross Graham, and she did it all, from typing to committee work. She was constantly on the phone touching base with the district, making sure that Fred Ornstein would stay Senator Ornstein. She knew everyone's politics. She knew the name of every club leader, every insurgent, and what seemed like every petition carrier on the west side of Manhattan. When it was the Mental Health Committee, Ross Graham learned about mental health very quickly. And when it was a joint legislative committee, remember them, on higher education, she learned about higher education, too. And she was one of those unsung soldiers with a passion for anonymity who took all the heat, was always the bad guy when something went wrong, and sometimes she sacrificed a lot. Somewhere on the west side, there is an assembly district that seemed to have Ross Graham's name written all over it, but I also remember the old days and her arranging for taxicabs that made the daily run to Joe's Restaurant on Madison Avenue, where she had already called ahead to order sandwiches for everyone in the office. I remember her collecting the money, so much for the sandwich, so much for each person's share of the cab expense. And there I was back in 1964 writing a doctoral dissertation, trying to remember how New York State and its Senate passed the Community Mental Health Facilities Act of 1963. I remember sitting in Ross's apartment in Chelsea, and she was reminding me of how it happened, how Ornstein went up against Nelson Rockefeller and got him off the dime on the act a year earlier than he wanted to, how Robert Kennedy was used to finesse the deal, and how Ornstein came to be named chairman of a new mental health committee when none had ever existed in the House before that year. And when I was so tired I couldn't type anymore, it was Ross Graham who took pity on me and said, "Let me," and typed out the last few notes. In those early days, there was very little money for Ross. Ornstein had to get a majority leader, Joseph Saretsky, on hands and knees and beg for enough to keep her on. And then, little by little, she was there for a year, and then two, and then three, and then, miraculously, Fred Ornstein, the, quote, bomb-throwing politician from the West Side, was the Senate's minority leader when everyone, from the New York Times to the elevator operators, was saying it couldn't be done. And when the smoke cleared, a ragtag group of women and minority members prevailed, and if you look closely through the smoke, you could see Ross standing there, fatigued but delighted, that she had been instrumental in putting it all together, again with a passion for anonymity. It was difficult. Ross knows what it's like to hurt. She knows what it's like to see others get the credit, but she's handled it so well, and she's a model for the rest of us, a model on how to behave in the good times and bad. Ross has a passion for helping women extend their political power. She's worked with countless feminist groups who have come to Albany in search of power. She's worked assiduously for the Center for Women in Government. She has posters of her two pals, Karen Burstein and Carol Bellamy, up on her wall. She had seen her dream gain power like a rolling locomotive, and she must be confident knowing that she is one of the people in the legislature who has done the most to extend the rights of women. As I have said, I have not always agreed with her, but I respect her, and I have respected few others in my whole life. Ross Graham is still a young woman. We'll see her do a lot more in her life. But from the vantage point of the New York legislature, there's going to be a big void where this wonderful and classy woman has stood for so long. Before signing off, I'd like to thank Associate Editor Rick Lipkowski for his contributions to the Legislative Gazette during the past 2 years. Rick is leaving us this week, and we wish him well in a new position in New York City. That's our show for this week. Join us again next week for another look at state government and politics. Bill Gralty edits and produces this program. Please address comments and questions to us at WAMC Box 13000, Albany, New York 12212. I'm Alan Chartok.
The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC News. Alan Chartok is executive producer. This program is made possible with funds provided by the State University of New York College at New Paltz.